From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Gunther Schuller, composer, conductor, critic, and former head of the New England Conservatory of Music. He's equally at home with jazz and classical music. 15 years of experience as a Secret Service agent is worth a lot, especially to author Gerald Petovich. Coming up, he'll tell us how he drew on his experiences for his crime novels To Live and Die in L.A. and Shakedown. We have some Cajun music in our performance spot today, and there are some new home video releases featuring one of TV's funniest ladies, Carol Burnett. Critic Ken Tucker has a review. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Gunther Schuller has made an impact on just about every facet of music. He's a composer, conductor, arranger, educator, critic, and historian. And he's made connections between parts of the music world that seem to be at odds with each other. Although he's from a classical background, he's been an ardent supporter of jazz, always insisting that jazz and classical music were different but equal in artistic value. Since the 1950s, he's been at the forefront of third-stream music. Third-stream is an expression he coined to describe music located halfway between jazz and classical music, combining the rhythmic vitality and improvisational spontaneity of jazz with the compositional techniques of classical music. The music Schuller composes is modern, yet he's always rooting around in the past, rediscovering music, then presenting it in concert and on record. For instance, he helped start the ragtime revival and conducted the Nonesuch recording of Scott Joplin's Redback Book. He's written extensively on jazz history. Next fall, Oxford University Press will publish his book The Swing Era, which is a companion to his book Early Jazz. Gunther Schuller is the former president of the New England Conservatory of Music and the former artistic director of the Berkshire Music Center at Tanglewood. I spoke with him from station WBUR in Boston. I asked him if he ever tried to specialize before branching out into so many different forms of music.
Not really. I seem to have been always fascinated by a multiplicity of musics. And some of that has to do with the fact that I, as a teenager, was growing up in New York, where through the many radio stations there, for example, there were three radio stations that carried classical music, and of course the many performing ensembles, but also jazz stations and stations that played other kinds of popular vernacular music. Through all of that, I somehow instantly became fascinated with this richesse of different kinds of musics. I had to specialize, of course, to some extent. I mean, that's what one has to do to make a living. And in that sense, I became a composer primarily of classical music and became a French horn player.
I knew you first through your work with third stream music. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that. First of all, let me ask you to describe in your own words what you meant when you coined that expression.
Yes, well, it was the bringing together of two main streams of music, classical and jazz. I perceive them as main and as equivalent in their quality, although different in style. And the marriage of these two main streams begets, as the Bible would say, an offspring, a child, and that is the third stream. Now, what I was not talking about was some kind of simplistic or superficial overlays of one kind of music on top of another, but a real integration at the most fundamental technical and conceptual and expressive levels. And part of the... Now, this is not a music that I invented. I simply gave it a name, a very simplistic name, as a matter of fact.
Did you run into resistance on both sides, resistance on the part of people involved with jazz and classical music, about the idea
absolutely.
Of merging the two in some way?
Oh, absolutely. And the resistance was in some cases very fierce. This is called often territorial protection. The people in classical music, many of them, didn't want their music contaminated, in quotes, by jazz. And jazz purists particularly didn't want any of the influence of what they considered effete or academic music in the classical area. But, of course, what they neglected to understand was that both musics, if we talk about classical and jazz as sort of major musical mainstreams, both musics have a lot to learn from each other, even to this day. I mean, classical music can learn a hell of a lot about rhythm and swing and momentum and motion in music and spontaneity through the improvisational aspects of jazz. On the other hand, jazz can learn an awful lot and still has to learn it, I think, about form and how you write or improvise extended pieces, you know, pieces beyond a 3-minute or 10-minute duration.
I want to play something that you wrote that is in a third stream style, and it's part of a larger piece that you wrote called Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. Let me ask you to just describe what's happening in this excerpt of the piece.
Well, this is one of many third stream pieces that I've written, and I've used a different approach to this idea in all these pieces. This is one that happens to have been written for a symphony orchestra, which means that you could not use improvisation, certainly not in 1959 when I wrote this piece. Symphony musicians are not trained in improvising, certainly not in a jazz style. So this piece is entirely written, but, of course, it tries to emulate the whole feeling of a jazz piece, only now not for a big band or a small group, but for a whole symphony orchestra. And the idea came to me, this is one of the Paul Klee paintings, it's called The Little Blue Devil. And blue and the blues sort of immediately makes me think of jazz, of course, and the blues. And so this has a kind of blues-jazz feeling, and particularly through the rhythm, the walking bass line and the muted trumpet solo and so on, various elements that relate to jazz.
Okay, so this is from the Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee, composed by my guest Gunther Schuller, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra with Eric Leinsdorf conducting. And I should mention that this is one of Gunther Schuller's most widely performed pieces. So let's hear it. An excerpt of Gunther Schuller's Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. How did you find a drummer like that in an orchestra?
Well, at that time, they had a drummer named Tommy Thompson, whom I knew from my days in Cincinnati, who was always sort of oriented towards jazz, so we were lucky in having that. I tell you, if you mess around with jazz, you better have a good drummer and a good bass player.
Really?
Otherwise, you're in trouble.
Now, you once wrote that you never really cared whether the term third stream stuck or not, but I'm sure that you did care whether the idea was furthered or not. Where do you see third stream type music heading now? Where do you see that marriage of jazz and classical music heading?
Well, it's expanded tremendously, and in my original postulation of this, I was mainly concerned with classical music, contemporary classical music, and jazz. But what has happened, particularly through some of my disciples in this, particularly Rand Blake, this amazing improvising pianist, is that it has been extended to include not just jazz as a popular or folk or dance music, but all kinds of ethnic folk and vernacular musics from all over the world. And of course, this is most appropriate in our times because the whole world of music has been opened up to us in recent decades through recordings and television and radio. I mean, there is no music on the face of this globe that we can not know about nowadays, so that you can have now a third stream which combines, let's say, Greek bouzouki music with atonal classical music and with elements of jazz.
Now, you talk about opening up different worlds of music. I think many of us have you to thank for introducing us to different forms of music. You've played an important role in expanding the repertory of jazz and pop music. For instance, you are at the forefront of, you know, the, excuse the expression, ragtime revival.
That's all right.
A few years ago.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and you found all kinds of interesting things that were, that had been totally forgotten by history. And I wonder what inspired you to look back to the turn of the century music.
Well, I've been asked that question many times, and I always find it difficult to explain. Again, a lot of the seeds for these kinds of interests, I guess, were sown in my childhood somehow, and I don't recall exactly how all that happened and developed. But many people think of me as a modernist, as a radical in music, you know, someone who's always sort of avant-garde of music. But I'm also, and this is what people sometimes don't know and forget, I'm also quite a traditionalist, and I'm very interested in always, A, making links back to the past, the recent past or the far past, and to preserve of those earlier traditions, be they popular or classical or whatever, those things which are really eternal and therefore of great value to preserve, and then to perhaps rejuvenate or renew or use in some new way, but never to lose that connection with the past. And I knew about Joplin's music since I'm a teenager, but I never could do anything about it as a French horn player. There isn't much you can do with piano rags. But when I got a hold of these orchestrations from the first decade of the century, the nickname of the Red Back Book of Rags, then I went to town, as this was during my time at the New England Conservatory, and created a ragtime ensemble immediately.
Well, I'd like to play one of the rags that you arranged from an album called From Rags to Jazz, which features the New England Conservatory Ragtime Ensemble. Let's play Heliotrope Bouquet by Louis Chauvin. Do you want to say anything about what you thought of when you were arranging this?
Well, my main interest was in keeping the classic style of ragtime pure. I mean, to keep a kind of period authenticity in these arrangements. It would have been very easy to update them or modernize them or to make them very fancy. But I was very interested in keeping in the pure classical style. And I learned that from the Red Back Book arrangements, which, of course, we performed. And that sort of gave me a sense of how those things were arranged in those days and how they were played.
Could you just explain briefly what the Red Back Book arrangements are?
Well, the Red Back Book is that's a nickname for a collection of printed orchestrated rags. The real title was 15 High-Class Syncopated Rags.
Okay, well, let's hear the Heliotrope Bouquet arranged by my guest, Gunther Schuller. Really nice arrangement of that.
For the record, we ought to say that that piece was composed by two composers, Louis Chauvin and Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin rescued that piece from oblivion. Chauvin died before he could finish the piece, and Joplin, who had heard the first two strains played to him by Chauvin, decided to finish this beautiful rag. So that's how come we have it.
Well, I want to talk with you more about music and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is composer, conductor, arranger, educator, author, and music critic Gunther Schuller, and we'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Gunther Schuller is my guest. Now, your father played in an orchestra. What did he play?
He was a violinist in the New York Philharmonic, many other orchestras, but primarily in the New York Philharmonic.
Did you hang out with him when you were a kid in the orchestra?
Yes, he took me to concerts. I guess I went to concerts in my mother's womb already. My whole childhood was filled with classical music and going to concerts of the New York Philharmonic and other New York ensembles and organizations. But interestingly, I didn't become conscious of wanting to be a musician until I was about 11. I was a rather late starter.
Well, were you intimidated by the caliber of musicianship that your father and his friends had?
No, that wasn't it. I was interested in art. I wanted to be a painter and an artist. And it's interesting that in some of my later musical works, I refer so often and associate myself with works of art, as in the case of the Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee. I wanted to be an artist, but at age 11, somehow all this musical knowledge and information and love for music that I had came out, and then suddenly it was very clear that I wanted to be a musician of some sort.
Now, you started your career playing in orchestras, but you gave that up. Why?
Well, I was playing in the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra as principal horn. I was there for some 15 years, one of the most exciting and great musical periods in my life. But by around 1959, if I'm trying to make this sound modest, my fame as a composer had become such that I was getting commissions from all over and from so many sources that I began to literally kill myself physically trying to be a French horn player by day and a composer by night. So I knew something had to give, and most reluctantly, because I loved the French horn and I loved playing in the opera, I gave up the horn. I mean, my primary calling, I always knew since the age of 11, was as a composer, and so that had to take priority.
Does this mean you never play anymore?
I haven't played for about 23 years. After I left the Met, I did freelance work in New York in the studios, you know, playing everything from symphonic music to jazz and pop music. But there again, you cannot be a part-time horn player. There's just no way. The embouchure, the muscles and all of that just won't take that kind. It's like sports. You have to sort of keep in training all the time. So eventually I had to give up the horn. And, of course, people were saying to me, you know, composers like Aaron Copland and Bill Schumann, saying, you know, if you're leaving this very good employment at the Metropolitan Opera, you're taking a great risk because you're not supposed to be able to make a living as a composer. But somehow I managed that, and during the 60s I lived and worked as a composer, I had to work very hard, of course, because that's a difficult life. Composing and music making is not exactly one of the exalted, financially most remunerative professions.
Now, as a composer, you've written that professional symphony musicians are sometimes embittered, disgruntled, bored musicians who have come to hate music. Now, did you ever feel that way at all when you were a symphony orchestra musician?
Not one second, not one minute, nor did my father, by the way, who played in the New York Philharmonic all those years. I mean, all through the years, and later when he played with the Cleveland Symphony and the Cincinnati Symphony and many other orchestras, he always enjoyed playing until he was age 82. And I knew quite a few other musicians who loved playing the great literature. But then there were also those, and perhaps I overstated a little bit in that sentence which you're quoting, there were always those who were, in fact, somehow embittered and disappointed, and to the point where sometimes they didn't even enjoy playing the great literature of Tchaikovsky, Brahms, Beethoven, whatever. I always found that amazing.
Well, I guess that was hard for you as a composer when an orchestra would play your music and you felt that they were bored and embittered.
Yes, or beyond that, hating music. I mean, many of these same musicians hate all contemporary music. I suppose it's because they find it too difficult. They have to think, they have to work hard, they have to practice. It just doesn't roll off their fingers, so to speak, as some of the more well-known literature does. But I wasn't reacting to that so much because of the reactions to my own music, but more I felt very unhappy that, for example, when Mahler symphonies were being played by the New York Philharmonic in those days, most of the musicians would gripe like mad about having to play these, what they thought were overly long symphonies. I mean, it's such a simplistic point of view. And some of the language that went on during the rehearsals, you know, while a man like Bruno Walter or Dimitri Mitropoulos was rehearsing these marvelous pieces, it was a shock to my system. I just couldn't believe that people could be so embittered and hateful in the very thing which they chose as their profession.
Do you think this is changing, this kind of bitter streak that you noticed?
It has improved a great deal, yes. And I can't explain why exactly, but I think some of it has to do with, of course, an influx of several generations now of younger musicians who are also more versatile and more varied and in their own view of music, the kind of thing we were talking about earlier. They relate to other musics besides the classical music, so they have a broader interest in the larger aspects of the field of music.
We heard earlier a piece that you composed that was a third stream piece, a piece that combined jazz and classical forms. I want to play an excerpt of a piece that's really not. And this is a string quartet that you wrote, the string quartet number 2. It's interesting to me that some of your pieces would be that jazz influence and some of them really not at all.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things, one of my problems with my life and my career is I get typecast so easily, and there are people who know me only as Mr. Ragtime, and then there are people who know me only in the jazz context, and then there are other people who know me only as that composer who writes all that difficult atonal 12-tone music. The point is that I love to write in all of these styles and conceptions and work in them as a performer. And out of the 130 pieces that I've written so far in my life, I think there's probably only about 25 or 30 that are involved with jazz or third stream. What's interesting is that very often my non-third stream pieces, non-jazz pieces, get reviewed by critics, for example, as being in this third stream arena. And I'm always quite amused and bemused by that.
Let's play an excerpt of your string quartet number 2 with the Emerson String Quartet performing. We've heard very different kinds of music that you've composed. What do you actually listen to at home?
Everything. our radio or our record players are on all the time, and I listen to everything from A to Z. I just love all... I have a voracious appetite for music, seemingly.
Now, you've been an educator. I think we need to talk about this. For 10 years, you were the head of the New England Conservatory. Now, you've criticized the education system in the United States for failing in all cultural matters, and you've said that you think that music education has always been shortchanged. How have you tried to remedy that in your work as an educator?
Well, by talking and by writing articles and by being an advocate for the arts in our education, I must say I don't think I've been incredibly successful. I think the fate of the arts in education today is worse than it was perhaps 30 or 40 years ago.
How so?
Well, I mean, there's just less of it. When you look at some other countries, Japan, Hungary, Germany, other European countries, and you see the amount of music or the other arts that is taught right in the school system, and you compare that with what happens in the United States, it's pretty deplorable here. This is almost a kind of national crisis at this point, and therefore, I mean, it's an issue which neither Gunther Schuller nor a few other well-intentioned people can solve.
You have a forthcoming book coming out, which is called The Swing Era. It's a companion to your earlier book, Early Jazz. I assume that to write this book on the swing era, you went back and listened to a lot of recordings that you already knew. Were there things that you've changed your mind about recently in putting this book together?
Well, quite a few things. Incidentally, I did listen to about 35,000 recordings.
Must have kept you busy.
Oh, it did. And part of the reason why the book took almost 15 years to write. Of course, I have to say that during some of those periods, times there were 2 or 3 years where I didn't write a single word or couldn't work on the book at all. Well, I don't know that I changed my mind so much, but I certainly made some very interesting discoveries. To put it simply, I think I have brought back to life certain major figures, what I think are major figures in jazz, which have until now been very much neglected, sometimes completely neglected, or treated very badly in the available jazz histories. On the other hand, I think I've also been able to demythify, to debunk some of the myths surrounding certain figures in the history of jazz.
In your book, Early Jazz, you wrote that very few jazz books have attempted to deal with the music in anything more general than descriptive or impressionistic terms. That's something you've tried to remedy with your writing. Do you think that jazz criticism has changed in that respect?
Oh, I think it is much better now than it was some 30, 40 years, although there were some quite brilliant writers, but they didn't, as you've just said, write particularly in any great detail about the music. There are now many more musically trained jazz writers and critics, although the emphasis seems to be still in most books that are published on this subject in the sort of anecdotal or historical aspects of jazz.
You've written about jazz a lot during your life, and so many of your articles are prefaced with the statement of, gosh, it's hard to put into words anything about music. Yet you've persisted with that challenge.
Well, I keep struggling with it. It is hard to talk about an oral art, music, in verbal terms, but I like to think that I'm getting a little better at it through the years, particularly in this swing era book. I think I made some breakthroughs in talking about the music in a cogent and informative and illustrative way.
Well, Gunther Schuller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been composer, conductor, and arranger Gunther Schuller. He's also a music critic and music historian. His forthcoming book, The Swing Era, is a companion to his book, Early Jazz. The Swing Era will be published by Oxford. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Natan Sharansky, the Soviet dissident whose imprisonment sparked an international campaign for his release. He now lives in Israel. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With 15 years of experience as a Secret Service agent, Gerald Petovich had plenty of material for crime fiction. He's the author of To Live and Die in L.A. and the new novel Shakedown. Coming up, we talk about crime from the perspectives of both agent and novelist. Our performance segment today features three members of the band Beau Soleil, who cook up some hot Cajun music. And critic Ken Tucker has a review of some new home videos featuring the best of comedian Carol Burnett. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. President Reagan left London today after a two-day stopover following his summit talks in the Soviet Union. Mr. Reagan enjoyed high praise from British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who called him one of the greatest U.S. presidents. She thanked Mr. Reagan for his latest meeting with General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev and says she supports the president's tough stand on human rights.
It was so characteristic of you, Mr. President, not to flinch from taking the fight for fundamental human rights to the very heart of the Soviet Union. Your words in Moscow will have shone like a beacon of hope for all those, wherever they are, who are denied their basic freedoms.
For his part, Mr. Reagan credited Gorbachev for the changes that have taken place in the Soviet Union.
In all aspects of Soviet life, the talk is of progress toward democratic reform in the economy and political institutions, in religious, social, and artistic life. It is called glasnost, openness. It is perestroika, restructuring.
The president noted that Thatcher had been among the first to suggest the West could do business with Gorbachev. Leading Soviet human rights advocate Andrei Sakharov held a news conference today in Moscow. It marks a dramatic step in Sakharov's re-entry into Soviet affairs since his release from internal exile 18 months ago. We have more from BBC's Jeremy Harris.
Dr. Sakharov used the platform provided by the authorities who once persecuted him to make an unflinching appeal for full human rights, civil and religious. Sizable changes had taken place, he said, but they didn't ensure full protection. Dr. Sakharov demanded the release of all remaining prisoners of conscience and freedom of emigration. He defended President Reagan's insistence on human rights during the summit. It had not been pressure or interference, but an expression of natural and genuine concern. Dr. Sakharov criticized official reporting of the president's meeting with dissidents, describing it as negative and prejudiced. However, he at no time criticized Mr. Gorbachev himself. The Soviet leader, he said, was a great statesman whose policies on human rights deserve trust, paid in advance if necessary. He added that the reform process had reached a decisive and dangerous stage, but he wished it well with all his heart and believed it would succeed in the end.
Jeremy Harris in Moscow. Secretary of State George Shultz flew to Cairo today for meetings with Middle East leaders to promote a U.S. peace plan for the region. Upon his arrival in Egypt, Shultz told reporters that it's not too late for a peace settlement. This is Shultz's fourth trip to the area to drum up interest in the plan, which so far has received little support. Shultz has a three-hour meeting scheduled tomorrow in Jordan, as well as a Sunday trip to Israel. A bomb exploded during the lunch hour today in a town near Johannesburg, South Africa, killing at least four people and injuring 19 others. The bomb was hidden in a trash can outside a bank. South African government officials have blamed this blast, as well as four other explosions which have occurred in the past 2 weeks, on the outlawed African National Congress. The ANC had no immediate comment on this latest attack. It's the deadliest bombing in South Africa in more than a year. A hospital spokesman in Boston says indications look good for Kitty Dukakis, who underwent 5 hours of surgery today to correct problems caused by two herniated discs. Mrs. Dukakis is the wife of Democratic presidential frontrunner Michael Dukakis. Doctors removed the discs from her neck and replaced them with bone taken from her hip. For the first time since last fall, the Labor Department today reported a rise in the unemployment rate. The jobless rate rose 0.2% in May to hit 5.6%. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 18 points to close the week at 2071.30. Advances led declines in trading of 189 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Cajun music is the music of the people of French Louisiana. During the month of June, three members of the Cajun dance band Beau Soleil will be featured on our weekly performance spot. Michael Doucette on fiddle and vocals, Michael's brother David Doucette on guitar, and Jimmy Bro on accordion. French music was brought to Louisiana by the Acadian people from France and Nova Scotia, and Michael Doucette says the music is still evolving.
Some of the music in Louisiana that we play, the French music, has been influenced by so many different things, from African music of the Caribbean to American music, Spanish music, Indian music. One of our heroes was a black accordion player, one of the first people to record this French music in Louisiana back in 1929. His name is Amade Ardoin, or his name was Amade Ardoin. I guess it always will be. Nevertheless, he died in the 40s, sort of mysteriously. But he recorded back then with a white fiddle player by the name of Dennis McGee, who is now 95 years old and still very much alive. They composed this song together, and we'd like to play it for you. It's called The Midland Two-Step. Okay, we'd like to do a song now by Dennis McGee, something he came up with when he was recording with Amade Ardoin. He also had a chance to record Twin Fiddles, and this is one of the songs he did that back then, 1929, called Valse à Pop, or Pop's Waltz. ¶¶
Michael Doucette, David Doucette, and Jimmy Brough from the band Beau Soleil. Their latest album on the Rounder label is Bayou Boogie. They'll be back with us again next week. This is Fresh Air. Gerald Petovich writes crime novels from an insider's point of view. As a Secret Service agent in Los Angeles, he tracked counterfeiters and guarded U.S. presidents and foreign dignitaries. In his biggest case, he worked with Scotland Yard to bust organized crime figures in a $12 million counterfeit scheme. Several years before leaving the Treasury Department, Petovich began writing novels. One of them, To Live and Die in L.A., was made into a movie by William Friedkin. Petovich's new novel, Shakedown, follows a federal agent's pursuit of an ex-cop turned extortionist in Las Vegas. I asked Petovich if he, like the characters in his novels, bent the rules to crack a case, or if he played it by the book.
No, I actually didn't play it by the book very much. Agents that play it completely by the book never make any cases, and so they always get promoted to high levels, usually, and they're very well liked by headquarters, but they're completely ineffective, and they don't really earn their keep as a Secret Service agent. So I was a guy that was always out there in the field. I avoided bureaucratic and administrative jobs while I was in the Secret Service for the 15 years. And I effectively, I think, became obsessed with the cases, like you see some of some of the protagonists in my books do. And I think I was quite effective.
When you started writing, did the people who you worked with in the Secret Service know?
This was top secret. I mean, I couldn't tell anybody. You know, the peer pressure of being a G-man and saying you're writing a book, I mean, people would think you were crazy or certainly effete or something. So I waited until I actually had sold the book to a publisher, and it was like a week before it was going to come out, and then I just happened to tell the agent in charge. And frankly, the Secret Service didn't know quite what to do about it. And they realized that I did have a First Amendment right to do that, and they just chose to not do anything about it. And, of course, I don't think that any of my books have ever really hurt the Secret Service. I'm not telling any actual top secrets of the Secret Service, and I'm not embarrassing anyone in it.
You said that you were afraid that people in the service would think that you were effete. Even if you were writing crime fiction, they would think that writing was effete?
Well, you know, cops aren't readers. They're doers, and they don't really understand writing. And
I have this image of you having to track down or arrest some really sleazy character, and you trying to concentrate on how they talk so that you could get it down for a character in your novel. Did anything like that ever happen?
Surprisingly enough, I've actually stopped and said, "Could you hold it a minute, buddy? I have to take some notes here." And actually written it down. Some of the dialogue is so good. I was interviewing a woman. I was looking for her husband who was a fugitive, and I asked her where he was, and she wouldn't tell me, and I could tell she was lying. So to try and get her to talk, I tried to ask her a few questions about what their relationship had been like and where she met him and so on. And she told me that once he came home and he was very angry, and he got so angry that he picked up this fish bowl and he stuck his hand in it and then broke it on the cupboard, and all the fish were all over the floor bouncing around. And I said, just a second. And I took out my little notebook and wrote that down.
You know, criminals must have a certain attraction to you since you write about them so much. You're so interested in the way they behave, the way they speak.
You know, you have to really try hard to be a crook. You know, it's not something you just kind of slide into. To be able to actually make enough to live on as a lifetime crook, which are the people that are the serious lifetime career criminals that I talk about in my books, and the people that are really the most dangerous in society. These are people who work very hard at what they do, and you know they're just twisted, and they're just on the wrong track, and they're never going to get off it. But they continue to go out with this self-destructive behavior, and they rationalize it and get right out of prison, and the next day they go right out and commit another major crime until they get caught.
I think you're best known for the novel To Live and Die in L.A., which was made into a film directed by William Friedkin. You co-wrote the screenplay with him. It's about two Treasury Department agents tracking down a sociopathic counterfeiter, and the agents are pretty crazy and unscrupulous, too. Do Treasury agents ever get into a lot of car chases and gunfights like in the story To Live and Die in L.A.?
The average policeman probably gets in more in a year or two than the average agent would get into in a career, but these things do happen, of course, and they usually only happen in the big cities with Treasury agents, but, you know, there's very few Treasury agents, and there's a lot of crime out there, so, and things, I have to say, are much more violent now than they ever have been.
Uh-huh.
Everything relates to narcotics, as it does in every other field of enforcement, and everyone's carrying guns. You know, when I first came on the Secret Service, if you found somebody carrying a gun, it was, you'd talk about it the next day. But then pretty soon everyone was carrying them. And I think a lot of it is dope. And also they just see it on television. You know, crooks think that's what they're supposed to do.
Let's talk about your new novel, Shakedown. Now, this is about an agent who's trying to get an extortionist to inform on a mobster. Did you have to rely on informants a lot when you were in the Secret Service?
As strange as it may seem, all cases are solved with informants. You know, there's virtually no cases in any field of law enforcement that are solved, major cases, that are solved by fingerprint clues or hair or anything like that. Physical evidence is something that comes in after you already know who did it, and somebody usually calls you up and tells you who did it. And, you know, I found out early on in my career that the way you made the big cases was by having the best informants. So over the 15 years I was in, I mean, I cultivated informants and people in the underworld that some of whom were very well-known criminals. You know, crooks don't give information because they're all sociopaths. You know, they don't give anything out unless it's in their self-interest. So what the good cop has to do is figure out what is in the other person's self-interest to get the information.
Well, what kinds of things are in a criminal's self-interest? What kinds of things could you offer someone who you were cultivating as an informant?
Well, in reality, you usually offer them an easy ride on a case. The forgery case that they were on, that you would go to the district attorney and recommend that they would get probation and so on. Or that they might have had a relative or a friend that they wanted some help on in a case. Some of them occasionally worked for money, but in this day and age, government funds don't match what's out there in the underworld to be made in narcotics and forgery. So almost all the good informants were in some kind of trouble, and they would come to you for some kind of help with their parole officer, or with a judge. Or with a prosecutor, and you'd give them that help so that they would, and you had to make sure that you were getting the better end of the deal, because otherwise it didn't work.
There's an agent in Shakedown who makes promises that he can't keep, such as protection. That sounds like a very unsafe thing to do, to make a promise you can't keep when you're cultivating an informant.
I think during the 15 years that I was an agent, I never made a promise that I didn't keep. And I went to great lengths to keep each and every promise, because once your name gets out in the underworld as a welcher, then you're through. No one will give you any information. On the other hand, if a crook is double-crossing you and he hasn't kept his word, then all bets are off.
Let me tell you what I think the funniest line of dialogue is in your new book, and I don't know if you're going to agree with this or not. But there's a scene where the ex-cop turned extortionist is on the phone with his girlfriend, and she's describing to him on the telephone all the sexual things that she hopes he'll do to her a little later. And he says, "I've got to go. I've got a time factor, hun." I just thought that was a riot. The time factor. It sounded like such a kind of bureaucratic type of language there.
That's, the greatest bureaucratic language I've ever seen is with confidence men.
Oh, really?
Confidence men always use, they always call things projects.
<And we're, laughs>
I'm working on a new project right now, and they always like to do things on the phone, and they like to have telephones and have 12 lines and, and speaker phones and everything, and of course it's all meaningless.
Very quickly, do you ever miss the Secret Service?
I have to tell you that I actually don't, because, you know, I was there for such a long time that by the time I left, it was somewhat of a bureaucratic drag. I finally was forced into taking a supervisory position, and I was sitting behind a desk, and I was kind of being one of the bureaucrats like I write about in my books that I don't like very much.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gerald Petovich has written 5 crime novels. His latest is Shakedown, published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Anything more from Moscow?
Yeah, so President Reagan, of course, is now in Britain, and he gave a speech at London's Guildhall today. But back in Moscow, Andrei Sakharov, the physicist and human rights activist, held a press conference and said that one of the Soviet dissidents who was at the lunch with President Reagan in Moscow at Spasso House, the ambassador's residence, lost his job, was fired from his job in Moscow within 24 hours after criticizing Soviet human rights policy. We'll have a report on that. Also on the town in Utah, where Soviet observers are going to go to verify the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Carol Burnett Show. It's been almost 10 years since the last program, but now there's a new home video featuring classic Carol Burnett comedy. Critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Typical of the random, unpredictable way that popular culture operates, Carol Burnett, of all people, is in the air these days. She's almost always mentioned in reviews of the new movie Tokyo Pop because it stars her daughter, Carrie Hamilton. Tim Conway, one of the old Carol Burnett Show crew, is attracting attention with his Dorf on Golf video cassette series. And right now in New York City, the Museum of Broadcasting is presenting The Many Worlds of Carol Burnett, a series of screenings that trace her career from an ingenue performer on The Gary Moore Show to her glory days on The Carol Burnett Show, a series that ran from 1967 to 1979. Some of the classic moments from her show can also be seen in a new video cassette called Carol Burnett's Personal Best. The Carol Burnett Show was, on its surface, a conventional variety show. As hostess, Burnett greeted her audience each week, did a little monologue, answered some questions from folks in the studio, and then acted in a series of comedy sketches. Everyone from Red Skelton to Dolly Parton has done the same thing. What distinguished the Carol Burnett Show was her stock company of actors, which included Harvey Korman, Vicki Lawrence, Lyle Waggoner, and Tim Conway, and the quality of the sketches themselves. When we think about the Carol Burnett Show, we think first about the parodies of movies and TV shows that Burnett and her writers savaged. At their best, they created the video equivalent of Mad Magazine, pointing out the foolishness to be found even in beloved works like Gone with the Wind. Burnett was so ingratiating and so enthusiastic that she could be vicious without ever alienating her fans. Take this, for example, from that Gone with the Wind spoof, which the Burnett Show called Went with the Wind. Here, Burnett as Scarlett O'Hara and Harvey Korman as Rhett, or Rat Butler, meet for the first time.
Sir, you should have let your presence be known. Just who are you and how did you get in here?
I'm Captain Rat Butler, and I arrived here by way of a streetcar named Desire.
You, sir, are no gentleman.
And you, Miss O'Hara, are no lady.
Darling, I love you. You and I are cut out of the same rotten, dirty cloth. Renegades, both of us. If it weren't for this blasted war, I'd marry you in a minute.
What war?
Many people remember The Carol Burnett Show as classic television, stuff to put in the time capsule along with Your Show of Shows and The Honeymooners. What this tape suggests, however, is that Burnett's work was more fragile than that of Sid Caesar's or Jackie Gleason's. A lot of the topical references in her sketches aren't funny a decade on, and the constant mugging and snickering that she and her co-stars indulged in now seems merely smug. Still, there's no denying her resourcefulness and her brains. Over the past few years, Burnett has taken on some serious dramatic roles, but none of them have conveyed the full range of her talent. That's what was on display every week on that variety show, and that's what's now captured on video cassette. Other new video releases include Baby Boom, the hit comedy starring Diane Keaton as a driven business executive who finds her life turned upside down when she inherits a baby. It's as brittle and predictable as any TV sitcom, but Keaton is amusing and energetic. There's also The Witches of Eastwick, in which director George Miller takes John Updike's novel and cranks up the misogyny while toning down the wit. Among the victims are Cher, Michelle Pfeiffer, Susan Sarandon, and Jack Nicholson's eyebrows, which waggle furiously in a vain search for laughs.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time I'll speak with dancer and choreographer Mark Morris. At the age of 31, Morris has become one of the most talked about, most commissioned young choreographers in American dance. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will profile another young performer, guitarist Joshua Breakstone. Though he's only 32 years old, Breakstone's style is rooted in the 1940s. And television critic David Bianculli will give us his take on a foolproof way of getting laughs, the laugh track. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Producing the show this week were Ed Doherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Our senior producer, Danny Miller, and his wife, Mary Schobert, just had their first baby, Karen. Congratulations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.